Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. This is the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. We begin today's show by discussing media coverage of the plight of migrants crossing the Mediterranean from war-torn Libya to Europe. Since January, more than 400 migrants have died making the perilous journey. On July 3rd, today's guest, Ben Ehrenreich, boarded the C.I. Ellen Kurdi rescue ship about 30 miles off the coast of Libya. This nonprofit organization has been patrolling the Libyan coast since 2016. According to their website, volunteer aid workers have rescued 5,568 people from acute stress. Ben Ehrenreich was on assignment for the New Republic. Ben Ehrenreich is a columnist with The Nation and author of The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. It's based on his reporting from the West Bank. Ben's forthcoming book is Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. And Ben Ehrenreich joins us from Spain. He's in Barcelona. Hi, Ben. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to have you. We've been following all of your Twitter updates about your journey on the boat, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you about that. But before we do, Ben, I should say we have not been covering Trump's latest racist Twitter rant. It's getting, as you know, wall-to-wall 24/7 coverage. And we talk about this, and we feel like everybody else is covering it. We don't think we can add anything at this time. Let's talk about the issues that are not being covered, which is the one that we're going to talk about with you. But since it is our media roundtable, and this is getting 24/7 coverage, I just wonder what your thoughts are about all of this coverage. Again, just to remind people, and I know you've heard this over and over again, but earlier this week, he tweeted that Representatives Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Rashida Tlaib should, quote, go back to the, quote, totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. And then 3 days later, at a rally in Greenville, North Carolina, the crowd chanted, send her back, as Trump railed against Ilhan Omar. And he paused and let this go on for about 13 seconds. So, Ben, overall, what are your thoughts on how this is being covered? And why don't we make a distinction? Because the TV networks love this, of course. I mean, this is great for TV. But what are your thoughts about radio and newspapers?
You know, I applaud you for not giving it wall-to-wall coverage like the TV networks have been and like many of the newspapers have been. You know, I think it's awful and disgusting and not in the slightest bit surprising. I mean, Trump has been saying racist things for, you know, since before he started running for president. And it's become, you know, it's his sort of his best and I think his only real political tactic is to distract everyone by saying something still more awful than the last thing he said. And the media, for the most part, eats it up and falls right into it. And whatever issues of substance were being discussed before he said whatever his latest outrageous statement, they all disappear. And very often they're things that he wants to disappear. And it always works. And I think it's really tricky from a media perspective because, you know, it is news when a president basically puts the lives of sitting Congress people in danger. It is news when he launches racist attacks on members of Congress. So you can't not cover it. But I think that there has to be some smarter way to deal with this so that the media is not always playing into his hands, which I'm afraid is what's happening now.
Yeah, and one more question on this. Given that he really started his campaign saying that Obama was born in Kenya, for example, Mexicans are rapists. On and on and on. As you said, when you talk about the wealthy, clearly they have done beautifully under this administration. I mean, stocks are up, CEO pay is up. But when you're talking about people who are not wealthy, they're going to look at their checkbook and say, nothing is changing for me. Things are getting worse, and you're trying to take away my health care. So this is all he's got at this point for those people. So this is what we can expect up until the election in 2020. How do you think the media should cover this? Because I think it's going to get worse. And frankly, I'm afraid for these women's lives at this point. I mean, I was reading on Twitter that law enforcement says that the death threats are just off the charts, especially for Ilhan Omar. So there's a couple things going on. Their safety, which is very real. And then just how should the media cover this from here on out?
Yeah, I mean, the outrageousness of these assaults has to be covered. You know, I've been really impressed with Ilhan Omar not only standing up to this, but going about her business as a lawmaker and introducing bills, signing bills that will, you know, make a real difference in working people's lives. And, you know, those bills are not getting anywhere near the coverage as you know, Trump's latest tweets. And we're seeing, you know, endless streams of the same op-eds and the same editorials of, you know, Beltway pundits either saying that Trump is a racist and they're shocked, like, he really is a racist, we must admit it now, or saying perhaps that he's not a racist, but these racist words should be condemned. And, you know, talking about these things that have been absolutely evident to anybody who's paying attention for, you know, for years now, the man is a racist, and that has been a large part of his appeal. And I think we need to grapple with that with a little more calm and intelligence.
Well, if listeners would like to write us and let us know how you think we should cover this, because we talk about it regularly, we would, obviously, as Ben said, it's very important. Anti-racists say it's very important to talk about this and also to bring in history. But with so much going on and so many very important issues being ignored, we also grapple with it. So if you have any thoughts you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. Your call at kalw.org. Today we're joined by Ben Ehrenreich. He is a journalist, columnist with The Nation. And on July 3rd, he boarded the C.I. Allen Kurdi rescue ship. It's about 30 miles off the coast of Libya. And this ship has been patrolling the Libyan coast since 2016. Ben, speaking of issues that don't get much coverage, you know, because of what's happening here in the United States and at the border, the horrific treatment of children and people who are coming from Central America, this issue of migrants leaving Libya and other countries to make it to Europe is getting coverage if you search for it, but not really headline news. So just can you give us an overview of what's really going on with migrants? When we're talking about Libya, how often are people leaving Libya to go to Europe?
Sure. And I think just a small correction. I think it was actually June 22nd that I got on board the Allen Kurdi, so it was a longer voyage than that. But there's been a steady stream of migrants coming across the Mediterranean through several routes. The central Mediterranean route goes from Libya usually to Italian ports. There's an island called Lampedusa, which is Italian territory, which is where most people who set out from Libyan beaches hope to end up. The people setting out are from all over the place. Many of them are from sub-Saharan Africa, fleeing war, fleeing poverty, fleeing climate change. Some are from the Horn of Africa, from Somalia, from Eritrea, from Ethiopia. Others are coming from as far away as Pakistan or Bangladesh, or from Syria. Because Libya has been in tumult since 2012, with really no functioning state institutions, it has both been an easy place to cross from, but also a site of really absolutely horrendous human trafficking, slavery, extortion rackets, abuse, which migrants fall prey to. In an act of rather extraordinary cynicism, the European powers have, since 2017, been relying on Libyan authorities, which often means local militia leaders, to attempt to stem the flow of migrants into Europe. Prior to that, at first the Italian Coast Guard in 2015 was actually doing an extraordinary job of rescuing migrants at sea after several spectacular shipwrecks in which hundreds were killed in, I believe it was April of 2015. I might be wrong about the date. Actually, I'm sorry, it was October of 2015. The rest of Europe refused to fund these Italian efforts. And Italy eventually said, we're not going to do this on our own. And they stopped funding the humanitarian effort they'd been sponsoring to rescue people at sea. Europe stepped in with several efforts which were not focused on search and rescue, but were focused more on securing their borders. And a number of NGOs tried to step in to fill the gap. And this was in 2015 and 2016. Some of the major NGOs like Save the Children and Doctors Without Borders, but also a lot of much smaller grassroots efforts like CI, the organization that had the boat that I was on, and another called Sea Watch, and some that are even smaller than that, where basically people in European civil society raise money to put a boat on the water to try to rescue refugees who were drowning in absolutely enormous numbers, just thousands every year. And since 2017, European authorities have been doing everything they can to stop the NGOs from rescuing people at sea. To criminalize this form of humanitarian relief, while at the same time pumping money and resources into the Libyan Coast Guard. Libyan Coast Guard is, and this has been established by numerous United Nations reports, as well as reports by groups like Amnesty International, the Libyan Coast Guard is intimately tied into the actual smuggling networks themselves that make enormous profits from enslaving and torturing migrants. So it's an extremely cynical and brutal game that Europe has been playing in order to keep its hands clean of this situation while trying to prevent migrants from arriving on European shores.
Ben, you mentioned human trafficking, and let's talk about this for a minute. Time magazine had a piece a couple of months ago called "It Was As If We Weren't Human Inside the Modern Slave Trade Trapping African Migrants." And they report that an estimated 650,000 men and women have crossed the Sahara over the past 5 years to go to Europe. According to the UN's International Labor Organization, there are more than three times as many people in forced servitude today as were captured and sold during the 350-year span of the transatlantic slave trade. And I had to read that line a couple of times. More than three times. And they focused on a number of people. For example, Sunde Ibaro, he's 32. He's got scars on his face made by a Libyan trafficker who held him captive. He's now living in a shelter in Benin City, Nigeria. Can you tell us more about this, Ben? What did you learn about human trafficking, how people are treated, and where they can go for help?
They can't really go anywhere for help, and which is why so many of them are trying desperately to get across the sea and into Europe. The migrants that I spoke with, because on the Alan Kurdi we did end up rescuing two boats filled with migrants, the first with 65 people and the second with 44 people, and had absolutely horrific stories. The first group was they were mainly from Somalia and then from several other countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And almost all of them had spent time in what amount to torture camps in Libya. Some of them are official prisons. Many of them are basically houses, factories, warehouses, which are run by some small faction of an armed group, where people are kept as captives. Basically, you know, someone will come from, whether it's from Somalia or from Nigeria, through some local smuggling connection, who will bring them into Libya. They'll make the crossing over the Sahara. And usually they'll pay up front for this crossing, and then they'll be put in a house or in a prison, and beaten and tortured until their families or their friends can raise money, whatever the figure is that the smugglers insist that they raise. People told stories of being beaten with sticks, being beaten with rubber hoses, being subject to electroshock therapy. Electrocution. You know, just really abysmal forms of torture. Pretty much everyone in that the first rescue we did had scars on their bodies. Some of them really, really awful from sustained torture. And most of those people, more than half of the people on that boat, were minors. Most of them were under 18. Some of them were as young as 12. Most of them had spent 2 or 3 years in Libya, sometimes being moved from one of these camps or secret prisons to another, sometimes managing to escape one or managing to raise the money so that they would be released from one, only to be picked up by some other faction and brought into another, you know, some other form of captivity. They also told stories of being essentially sold as slaves, that sometimes if you can't raise the money that they ask for, they will sell you to private citizens who need laborers, and having to work, you know, doing agricultural labor, doing construction work, doing various forms of heavy labor, you know, without being paid and being kept in horrible conditions. So yeah, it's a really horrific system, and it's not in the slightest bit secret. You know, I mean, there've been many journalistic reports on this. There've been many NGO reports on this. There've been UN reports on this. It's widely known.
Ben, who is running these camps, and who is carrying out this torture? Do we know?
Yeah, I think it varies. After Gaddafi fell in Libya, the country fragmented, and I'm far from an expert on all the various factions within Libya. But various militias that had formed in the fighting to overthrow Gaddafi kept their weapons. Some were integrated into a sort of loosely formed national army. Others remained as separate factions. And as I understand it, there are major factions, but basically cities retain a lot of independence. So there'll be a militia which controls a certain city, which may be allied to one or another larger force. And the militias in those cities will control various forms of smuggling, both human smuggling for the ones on the coast. There's also a lot of fuel smuggling, since Libya is a major oil nation. And basically any way that they can make a profit. And then there's fighting between various factions for control of these routes.
Today we are joined by Ben Ehrenreich, a columnist with The Nation, who joined the C.I. Allen Kurdi rescue ship about 30 miles off the coast of Libya on June 22nd. This nonprofit has been patrolling the Libyan coast since 2016, and according to their website, volunteer aid workers have rescued 5,568 people from acute stress. Ben will be with us for the next 5 minutes or so, so if you have any questions or comments on coverage of this issue of migrants taking this perilous journey crossing the Mediterranean from war-torn Libya to Europe, we'd love to hear from you. Ben was on this boat, and he's going to be writing about it for the New Republic. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Ben, you gave us an overview of what is happening in Europe. Can you talk more about that? Malta and Italy have stopped humanitarian aid ships with migrants aboard from docking in their ports. In Germany and Italy, you talked about that, just about what right-wingers are saying about migrants. Can you talk more about just, you know, what has really changed in terms of which countries are allowing these boats to dock in their ports?
Well, right now, Italy is not allowing anyone in. You know, while I was at sea, another NGO ship, the Sea Watch 3, had to defy a Italian blockade in order to dock and disembark the migrants they had rescued at sea. And things in Italy have certainly gotten worse since the right-wing government took power there in June of last year. But I think it is worth mentioning that, you know, just as the situation along the U.S. border has gotten a lot worse since Trump took office, in Italy, all of the groundwork for the current system and the deals made with Libya was made by the previous government, which was a center-left government. And, you know, in the same way that I think a lot of the infrastructure for the current disaster at the border was established under Bill Clinton in the mid-1990s. And, you know, so I think there's a lot of similarities between the so-called migrant crisis in the U.S. and in Europe. In the U.S., various governments, Trump, you know, Trump's being one of them, have relied on the you know, dangers of the desert to discourage people from crossing, which has meant that thousands have died attempting to cross the desert from the mid 1990s on. In Europe, it's the sea, it's the Mediterranean that provides the same kind of geographical barrier. And I think very cynically and very consciously, European authorities have counted on the sea as acting as a deterrent to prevent migrants from crossing. But it doesn't work that way, because when people are fleeing for their lives, they will take whatever risk they can. So, you know, I think the last year, I think it was more than 2,000 who died in the Mediterranean. The year before, it was 3,000. A couple years before that, it was as many as 5,000. And I think these numbers are the numbers count the deaths that we know about, not the many, many boats that are launched that are simply never heard from again.
Well, Ben, before we let you go, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for a good program, as usual. Very disturbing. And my question is this. Leaving aside the responsibility of the states north of the Med, but this tragic situation translates into a real collapse of African states. I'd like to hear your guests discuss that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Max.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, one thing that doesn't get talked about at all in when these issues are talked about in Europe are the histories that are driving people to cross. And I think it's really difficult to talk about the desperation that people are fleeing from without talking about, first of all, the ongoing colonial legacies of extraction from African nations by European countries, where all of the wealth is just being pulled out of these countries. But I think you also have to talk about the collusion of local elites in most African countries in this process. In much of Africa, you have multinational corporations pulling out huge amounts of wealth that does not get distributed to the people at all, and you have a small local elite which enriches itself through its complicity in this process. And the result is that people live in devastating poverty and do whatever they can to get out. So I think Europe is complicit in that process, the United States is complicit in that process, and absolutely the local elites that profit from it are complicit in it. And, you know, if any of this is going to be addressed with any seriousness, then all of those factors also have to be addressed.
Well, thank you for that call, Max. You just gave us an idea to do a show about that and also just to tie in Ben's answer. I also wanted to ask you, Ben, just thinking about just people moving, and I think about climate change. And when you look at what's happening in Africa, I mean, climate change is already lessening crop yields and production. A third of Africa's people already live in drought-prone regions. Climate change could put the lives and livelihoods of about 250 million people at risk, according to the UN. And I was just reading The Guardian this morning. The world is increasingly at risk of climate apartheid, where the rich pay to escape heat and hunger caused by the escalating climate crisis, while the rest of the world suffers. This is according to a report from Philip Alston. He's the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. And his report concludes that human rights might not survive the coming upheaval. So in some ways, this is basically the beginning of what's to come, and in so many parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely, Rose. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think what we're seeing now is the merest trickle of the kind of migration that we're going to see, in decades to come. I was really disturbed, but also interested to see. In 2017, I think it was, I was in Somalia for writing a piece for the London Review of Books about the drought that was devastating the Horn of Africa at the time, that was basically making it impossible for people to live in the ways they had been living for a very long time, and was pushing people out of most of the countryside and through a good swath of the country and the region. And I was one of the first people I talked to of this group of Somali guys on the ship last week or the week before, was from the very regions that I'd visited, and had left those regions at basically the same time that I had been there, during the height of the drought. And most of the people I talked to, who had left around the same time, they didn't say I left because of climate change, and they didn't say I left because of drought. They would say I left because there was no way to live there. They'd say I left because there were no possibilities there and there was no future there. But I think, one of the things that made it impossible to live there and that meant that there was no future there was clearly climate change. So I think what we're seeing already is a migration that's being caused by changes in the climate.
And Ben, before we let you go, what is it like on the boat? I mean, how crowded is it? How desperate is it? What is just the overall feeling on these boats?
Well, the boat itself was, I think, 38 meters, which is, I'm not sure, 130 something feet, I guess. And it was an old boat. It was when there were no when it was just the crew on board, it was not terribly crowded, but not terribly roomy. The crew, I think, was in fairly good spirits for most of the trip, and very committed and very serious about the work they were doing. I think we were fairly lucky in that the people we found were not in, had not been at sea for a very, very long time. Other boats frequently find people who've been drifting for days, where many people are dehydrated horrifically, and their bodies in the boats that they find. Everyone we found, with a few exceptions, was in reasonably good health, and mainly they were extremely happy to be alive. After a few hours or a day, basically, of sort of being in shock that they had been rescued and that they were alive, people were in pretty good spirits. Their goal was to get to Europe and to get out of Libya, and it seemed they had done that and they were alive. It's good to be around people who are really, really happy to be alive and can't believe their good fortune. So I think people, for the most part, were the mood on board was not one of desperation. It was one of anxiety, but also of enormous hope.
Wow. Well, Ben, we look forward to reading about your trip and reading your piece in the New Republic. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose. It's been a pleasure.
Ben Ehrenreich is a columnist with The Nation. He was on assignment for the New Republic when he boarded the C.I. Alan Kurdi rescue ship about 30 miles off the coast of Libya. And you can find more information about the work they do and Ben's work at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Ellie Mystol, who is a contributing writer for The Nation, and he is out with a new piece called Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about a new cover story for The Nation magazine called Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts, how the 45th president has packed the courts with ultra-conservatives and reshaped the judiciary for a generation. We are joined by Ellie Mystol, executive director of Above the Law. This is a website that looks at behind-the-scenes look at the world of law. It also provides original commentary on breaking legal developments. Ellie is also a contributing writer for The Nation and legal editor for WNYC's More Perfect. Hi, Ellie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Ellie, before we dive in and talk about the important piece you wrote for The Nation, I just want to ask you, you've been on national media, including MSNBC, talking about Donald Trump's latest racist tweets. And I should say we have not been covering that because it's been getting 24/7 coverage. And we wanted to focus on things that are not getting enough coverage, like your story, for example. And so what are your thoughts? I mean, you know what kind of gets me is I feel like the media just continue to ask the same questions. What do you think about what Kellyanne Conway said? What do you, you know, how, right. What can we do that's fresh and new to bring to this?
That Donald Trump is a racist is just not news. We've known this right. Since he started with the birtherism stuff, which is why he was a presidential candidate in the first place. And if we didn't know it with the birtherism stuff, then we certainly knew it when he came down the escalator and he called all Mexicans rapists. And if we didn't know it then, we've known it multiple times when he banned Muslims, when he his ridiculous immigration policies, like when he called people from Haiti, which is where I'm from Queens, but my father is from Haiti, that Haiti was an S-hole country. I mean, like, there is nothing new about the news that Donald Trump is racist. The only new thing that's happening, you know, this week and a half is that imperceptibly small, more amount of kind of white mainstream media pundits are finally willing to use the R word to describe Donald Trump and his supporters. But I'll tell you what, in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks, they'll go back to saying, oh, Trump's racially tinged policies, you know, and the next time he is more overtly racist, they will, like, rediscover his racism yet again. It's a constant distraction. There's a great quote from Maya Angelou that actually Ilhan Omar is sharing right now on Twitter that says that, you know, the function of racism is to distract people from other more important issues, right? And that's exactly what Trump is doing with his base. He's holding up his racism, which his base is incredibly excited about and, you know, chanting about and whatever, and he's holding that up as the distraction while he takes away the rights of the very people who are cheering him on, you know, as they cheer.
And since you brought up Ilhan Omar, I mean, it's interesting to see how these women of color are responding to him. She is doubling down in an interview yesterday or the day before. She actually called him a fascist. I think that's the first time that I've heard a politician so blatantly say that Trump is a fascist.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think one of the reasons why the women of color that he is attacking are so kind of ready for these attacks and know how to respond to it is that, you know, as people of color, you've dealt with Donald Trump before. Donald Trump, that kind of person, has been a constant part of your life. The reason why these, like, you know, go back to where you came from comments are so disturbing to so many people of color is that every person of color has heard those comments at some point in their normal life. You know, I said on the tubes the other day that, you know, the first time I heard it, I was in third grade. And I knew how to respond to it because my parents had trained me how to respond to it by the time I was in third grade because they knew I was going to hear it. So, I mean, the four congressmen are ready to respond to Trump because they've had to respond to Trump-like arguments their entire lives. It's kind of, again, it's kind of centrist white people who don't really realize what racism is in this country, who are kind of having trouble being like, well, what do we do with this? I don't know how to respond. You know, that those are the people who are kind of, like I say, rediscovering Trump's racism. The women of color, they've known that forever.
At the same time, under the radar, this administration continues to dismantle regulations. They're hell-bent on dismantling the Affordable Health Care Act. They're restricting abortion, making it incredibly difficult for people, especially poor people, people of color, to access a basic right. They're changing the judiciary. You've written about this for decades to come. So before we dive in and talk about your piece, in the coming year, up the next year and a half before the 2020 election, how do you think reporters should navigate this ecosystem? Because real policy changes are happening so quickly under this administration. And at the same time, the tweets is all he's got, especially for people who are not wealthy. And I'm afraid it's going to get uglier and uglier. So how do you think the media, and with our last guest, Ben Ehrenreich, I said if we can make a distinction, because this is perfect for television. They love this. It makes them a lot of money. But what about radio and newspapers, for example? How do you think they should move forward?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the conundrum that we've had since, again, since Trump came down the escalator, right? Like the tweets, the comments, the rallies, they're shocking, and they do deserve coverage because what he's saying is insane. On the same time, if all you do is cover the tweets and the rallies and the, you know, random White House lawn statements, then you absolutely miss the real danger, the real policies, the real things he's doing to the country. So you have to try to cover both. And I think that the way I try to handle it and the way that I suggest other people handle it is that, yeah, it's how much time are you going to spend, right? You are going to spend some time on the tweets. That's just almost impossible, right? But if you've got, you know, if you've got a whole front page that's going to have four articles, right? Are all four articles going to be about some dumb thing that Trump said? No. You have one, you put it in the left-hand column, and in the right-hand column, you have your actual reported, actual journalism, long-form story about what is actually going on. We have to be able to do both. We have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, if anyone would like to call in or email about these tweets, the latest racist tirade, and how you think the media, how you think we should cover it, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today we're joined by Ellie Mistal. Is it Mistal?
It's Mistal. It rhymes with Crystal.
Mistal, thank you. I wanted to make sure and get your name right. Miss Ellie Mistal is executive editor of Above the Law and contributing writer for The Nation. And he's got a cover story in The Nation called Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts, how the 45th president has packed the courts with ultra-conservatives and reshaped the judiciary for a generation. So, Ellie, we have been covering this on a regular basis. And you write, as of this writing, the administration has had 123 federal judges confirmed, including 41 to the federal courts of appeal. This is the circuit courts, just one rung below the Supreme Court. By comparison, at this point, Barack Obama had pushed only 19 circuit court judges through to confirmation. So give us some context here. Talk about the significance of 123 federal judges being confirmed.
Right. So everybody is focused on the Supreme Court, or at least liberals know that we're supposed to focus on the Supreme Court. That's still kind of in training. But for the most part, people get that the Supreme Court is important. What people don't understand is that we have an entire federal judiciary system under the Supreme Court that is every bit as important. To put that in context, the Circuit Court, which is the court right below the Supreme Court, handles most of the law that is decided in the region where you live. The Supreme Court last year only heard about 70 cases. That's out of 7,000 cases that were appealed to the Supreme Court after a circuit court ruling, and that doesn't even count you know, hundreds or thousands of cases that were never appealed to the Supreme Court to begin with, right? So for a lot of law, the circuit courts are kind of your final arbiter. And below that, the district courts are your trial courts, so they're your first arbiter, right? And these positions are incredibly important. Because of what Trump and really what Mitch McConnell has been able to do, Trump judges now control 14% of the entire federal judiciary, as well as 22% of these critical circuit courts. And it's kind of happened without people noticing. It's happened under the radar. Again, people are kind of getting updates from Ruth Bader Ginsburg's Fitbit because we're so terrified that she will be mortal. But right below her, Trump is stacking the courts with these arch-conservative justices appointed for life who will be able to shape the law over the next 20 or 30 years.
And this is also very important. You remind us that the Trump court is not actually Trump's idea. You write, he probably wouldn't be able to tell you the difference between Chief Justice John Roberts and Judge Wapner, but Trump has been all too happy to play along with the game orchestrated by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate enablers because it's a deal. And, you know, people, the other thing that drives me kind of batty about all of these tweets is that the media keep asking the same questions. Why aren't Republicans speaking out? Just look at the courts. They're getting what they want under Trump. I mean, they couldn't get a lot of this under George W. Bush. So give us a picture. Remind us who laid the groundwork for these judges.
This is a generational project from the conservative movement that started basically when they realized in the 70s that they weren't going to be able to force feed their agenda upon the rest of the nation if they didn't control the courts. So in 1982, the Federalist Society was started, and that is a right-wing, ultra-conservative, non-profit legal organization. And their point for the past, again, 30 years or so, has been to identify, incubate, train, and promote a certain type of judge, a certain type of jurist, who will eventually rubber stamp the Republican agenda upon the country. And that they've been extremely effective at doing that. They're well funded. The Federal Society is. They're funded by, you know, name a big time conservative donor and they will fund the Federal Society. The Koch brothers, the Scaife Foundation, the Mercer family, all of those people put money into the Federal Society. There's no liberal counterpart, and they have been pushing for exactly these kinds of judges, so that when you link up the Federal Society to a true kind of Darth Vader figure in our politics that is Mitch McConnell, you have the kind of perfect storm. Mitch McConnell, everybody knows Mitch McConnell blocked Merrick Garland, Obama's justice appointment to the Supreme Court. But people forget that Merrick Garland was just the capstone. Merrick Garland was the end of a process, not the beginning of a process. Mitch McConnell was successfully blocking Barack Obama judges throughout Barack Obama's tenure as president. Mitch McConnell was doing this when he was minority leader, to say nothing of what he was able to stop and obstruct when he was majority leader. So that by the time Trump took office, there were 106 federal vacancies on the judiciary. Now, I don't know if that's a record, because I imagine George Washington had a lot of judges to appoint too, but from a modern perspective, 106 vacancies is amazing, and that's all because McConnell obstructed Obama for 8 years while Obama was president.
Let's also talk about who he's appointing. These people, as you report, are largely very young and inexperienced. You write they have an unsettling number have earned their stripes as partisan think tank writers, op-ed columnists, or in some cases even bloggers. They believe in deregulation to the point of corporate anarchy, meaning that significant climate change proposals might have to wait until they can be enacted over these judges' literal dead bodies. And they don't resemble the rest of the country. 78% are male, 87% are white.
Yeah. I mean, look, everybody understands that Trump has promised, that McConnell has promised, that the Federal Society wants judges who oppose abortion, who oppose the woman's right to choose, who oppose women's right to access health care, and who are willing to overturn the precedent of Roe v. Wade. Everybody understands what they want, that's what they want. Everybody understands that's what they've gotten. However, what people don't get is that when you find a judge who is willing to oppose such long-settled Supreme Court precedent like Roe v. Wade, what you're getting is a kind of jurist who is willing to oppose all sorts of other things that come along with that package, right? So the same kind of judge who thinks that a woman doesn't have a right to her own body is exactly the same kind of judge who doesn't think gay people should be allowed to be married, who is exactly the same kind of judge that doesn't think that transgender people deserve, you know, equal rights, who is exactly the kind of judge who doesn't believe in voting rights, who is exactly the kind of judge who doesn't believe in gun restrictions, right? That's all part of the same package. So when you say, like, oh, this judge opposes abortion, that's not like their one super conservative principle. It comes in an entire kind of grocery bag of stuff that most of the country finds troubling, and certainly most progressive find to be an anathema to what they think this country should be about.
Today we're joined by Ellie Misdahl, Executive Director of Above the Law. Given that you're Executive Director of Above the Law, which focuses on the world of law, you're very familiar with how these issues are covered. What do you think about how Trump's court is being covered in the media?
Poorly. And that's not, and there are two problems with it, right? One is that people who report on courts, who report on decisions, are trained to do the lawyer thing and understand that there are two sides to every argument. And there are two sides to every argument. Anybody who's been to law school can argue any side of any issue that you give them, right? Like, that's how we're trained. But just because there are two sides to every argument does not mean that those two sides are equal. And so Trump consistently makes legal arguments, Trump's lawyers consistently make legal arguments that are wackadoodle, that are actually crazy legal arguments. But most of the media doesn't have the kind of skill set to understand the difference and to understand, oh, well, that's a standard Republican argument, but this thing he's saying now, that's just crazy. Like, people don't have the core competency to understand that, and so that a lot of Trump legal arguments get covered as if, you know, who knows, six of one, half dozen of the other. And so that's just completely wrong and kind of completely frustrating to see. The other thing that happens a lot is that, you know, court reporters who haven't been to law school, of which there are a lot. Some of the best haven't been to law school, but it's you know, just like, you know, some of the best tech reporters, you know, can't code. That's not a problem in and of itself. But especially the reporters who haven't been to law school, what you find is this desire to treat judges as if they are kind of disembodied heads just pontificating on the law without political agendas attached to them. And that is just not true. That hasn't been true in this country for a very long time. So instead, you know, John Paul Stevens just passed away, former Justice John Paul Stevens, and a lot of the obituaries about him have noted that he was really one of the last true centrists. He got painted as a liberal because the court lurched so far right over his tenure. But he was one of the last true, just like, you make him an argument, and then he makes his best guess as to which argument is right. That's not the kind of justice we have anymore. That's not the kind of courts we have anymore on either side. What we have are kind of agenda-driven justices who are trying to impose their particular political agenda upon the law, and most of the court reporting media either doesn't want to or doesn't have the core competency to explain, you know, well, of course John Roberts is not in favor of voting rights, because voting rights mean Republicans like John Roberts don't win elections. So of course he's going to rule against voting rights if he can possibly find a way to do it. We don't have a lot of competency to explain that to the general public.
And also, what about the media equating the left to the right, for example? If you look at, for example, Merrick Garland, who was pretty moderate a number of nonprofits said, you know, we never even knew the guy. He didn't rally the base. You know, Obama chose someone so incredibly safe, and so we didn't get out to fight for him. Whereas you cannot compare Merrick Garland to any of these justices on the right.
Merrick Garland is not the liberal equivalent of Neil Gorsuch, who ended up taking that seat, right?
Are any of the Democrats
right?
on the court?
And this was part of Obama's philosophy. I mean, if we're going to criticize Obama, this is where I feel like the criticism is quite valid. His judicial philosophy was very centrist as a person who appoints people. You know, Elena Kagan, who replaced the retired John Paul Stevens, is not a progressive firebrand. She's a precedent-loving legal centrist who gets painted as a liberal because the court has shifted so rightward. I think that was a mistake. I think that we should have been appointing more hardcore progressive judges. As I said in one piece recently, you know, standing on the center of a seesaw does nothing to balance it out when there's an elephant squatting on the other side. All right, the Republicans have put their thumb on the court so heavily towards the right that in order to balance it out, what you need is for liberals and Democrats to appoint hardcore progressives on the left. That's how you achieve balance on the court, not by appointing centrists. Centrists are just going to end up sliding to the right anyway because of how rightwardly tilted the courts are right now.
And Ellie, we've got about 30 seconds left. Can you just talk about just how important this is and how significant this is? As you write, he's reshaping the judiciary for at least a generation, right?
Most of Trump's policies will be overturned by the next president with a stroke of a pen. He has been legislatively inept for the most part. Almost all of his policies are done through executive order, and that means that almost all of his policies can be rescinded through executive order when there's a new president. But the courts, these people are appointed for life. And so if you care about something like gun regulation, you have to control the courts. Because if you don't control the courts will strike down your gun regulation. If you care about climate change, you have to control the courts. Because if you don't control the courts will strike down your regulations on carbon emissions or mercury dumping or whatever it's going to take to start to hold back the onslaught of the sea, right? So if you care about any of these kind of hot-button political issues, you can't get it done if you have to continue to appeal to Trump's 78% male, 87% white, the other way around, Circuit Court and Supreme Court.
Well, Ellie, thank you for writing about this issue, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ellie Mistel is executive editor of Above the Law and contributing writer for The Nation, and you can find his cover story, Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts, at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.